The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Before we start today's podcast, I want to tell you about a new exciting program called Rewire You. It's Second City's take on professional development, using the skills of improvisation to navigate an ever-complex and challenging business world with greater authenticity and resilience. More importantly, we have partnered with the Chicago Booth School at the University of Chicago to infuse the program with cutting-edge research from the world of behavioral science. Rewire You is great for current and future leaders who want to get more from themselves and their teams. You can find out more at secondcity.com/rewireu. Classes begin soon. Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Cal Newport. Cal is an associate professor of computer science at Georgetown University. He is the author of a number of books, including Deep Work, which has been widely praised by the New York Times Book Review, The Wall Street Journal, and The Economist. Cal also explores related ideas on his popular Study Hacks blog. Cal Newport, welcome to the show.
Ah, thank you for having me.
When we were setting up this interview, I mentioned that reading your book, Deep Work, was providing me with a great deal of angst in that you present a compelling case that social media and internet use is actually making individuals today work at a more shallow and less productive pace. Finishing the book was like looking into a shame mirror for me. And I mean that actually in a good way. I know it doesn't sound like that, but I wonder if that's something you've heard from folks who have read your work.
I have. In fact, that was the original title of the book, was Shame Mirror. And my publisher thought, you know, we should change that.
Bad idea. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little dark. Yeah, it was a reflective cover. It has been a common response that people start reading it and then they tell me, I recognized something in my own life, and then that's what kept them reading through. Fortunately, however, the follow-up that tends to be, but there's some hope that I can change the things that I'm a little bit upset about.
Right. And you can imagine the time in which I've been reading this book the last 2 weeks. I mean, my social media feed is like an explosion every 5 seconds. And I'm talking about friends on the right, friends on the left, trying to make sense of what's going on or arguing with each other. And it's so addictive to like dive into that. And then I'm like, no, I've got to read your book, which is about exactly this.
Yeah, I think the last couple months has been a great case study and at least the power some of these tools can have over our mental state.
Yeah. So let's start this, though. Let's start with a definition of deep work, because you write that deep work is professional activities performed in a state of distraction-free concentration that push your cognitive capabilities to their limit. So what's an example of deep work?
So for example, if you're trying to write something or you're trying to put together some computer code or formulate a strategy or make a creative insight, the core is you need to be pushing your brain to its limit, and you need to be doing that concentration without the quick checks or distractions that too often actually characterize what we typically call work these days.
Yeah, so that could be a craft, like it could be someone, you know, making a guitar, it could be someone writing code, it could be someone writing a novel, any of that stuff.
Yeah, so deep work is defined both by what you're working on, so something cognitively demanding, as well as how you do it. So the fact that you're distraction-free is sort of orthogonal to the activity itself, but it's how you do the work. So how you do the work has to be free of distraction, and what the work is something that's really pushing your skills to their limit.
I've told this story before, and it's in my book, that we were leading an improv workshop at the Spertus Museum, and the guy who ran the Spertus Museum, Hal Lewis, is an expert in Jewish leadership and a lot of knowledge in management, and he looked at these exercises we were doing, and he goes, like, you're doing Peter Drucker, and I'm like, who is Peter Drucker? And I went home, and I read about him, and this concept of knowledge workers, you know, became, you know, rather important in his really still important. And you write in this book that most knowledge workers, a group that's rapidly forgetting the value of going deep. This is the kind of worker who makes up most of our workforce now.
Yeah, or at least an increasing part of the workforce. And that's why I think the notion of deep work is so relevant today. It's not just that deep work is important for succeeding in knowledge work, but my read of economic trends is that it's becoming increasingly important. That is, as we go forward in the future, the better you're able to focus, the more time you spend focused, the more successful you're going to be. So it's a trend that's going up. It's getting more important at exactly the same time that I think people are getting worse at it.
Everything that's around us is getting, I mean, it's the same thing with like the aging population, right? That we know that we're going to run out of caregivers in 5 or 6 years, and we seem to be doing nothing about it. In the same thing, what you're saying, which is, you know, we're going to need to go deeper, and all we're doing is sort of surrounding ourselves with distraction.
Right, because if you make a living using your brain, you take in information, you think hard about it, and produce something that's valuable to the economy, the trends we have right now are that the more time you spend doing low-level activities, things like moving information around, answering emails, chatting on Slack, going to meetings, these are things that increasingly can be automated or replaced or outsourced as we go forward. It's really going to be the deep stuff where you really push the mind hard to produce things of real rareness and real value. That's the stuff that's going to remain. That's going to be the key to remaining viable in this economy. And that's entirely an activity built around an ability to concentrate.
And the opposite of this is what you call frantic shallowness, which is a real problem.
Right. The opposite of deep work is shallow work, which is things that doesn't require you to push your brain to your limit, or things that are being done in a state of distraction. And the right way to think about it, I think, is that shallow work is what stops you from getting fired. But deep work is what gets you promoted. And so you can't just have the shallow work in your life because you're not actually improving your skills. You're not producing to your fullest capacity.
Wow, that's interesting. I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot because I think it's something that we see at Second City, because we experience artists who are taking their first improv class at a young age. And very often 5, 6, or 7 years later, a handful of them are performing together on our resident stage, where they become sort of masters in the art of improvisation. So you have the spectrum that starts at shallow and ends deep. And, you know, I also think about their experience of going into a classroom for 3 hours with no cell phone to have to experience each other and doing that over a period of, you know, these 8 week chunks where they're doing it, 3 hours once a week. And then as you become more professional, you're turning off that phone even more because then you have rehearsal and then you have the show. And so this sort of act of being engaged with others. And when you're improvising, because you have no script, you are required to be listening at your deepest depth. And then in the sort of, fast brain, slow brain thing, you have to then also draw on this other thought. So it feels like we have this sort of microcosm that proves your thesis right, especially if you look at the success of all the people who've come out of our theater.
Right. I mean, I think these ideas apply basically anywhere where we have craftsmanship. And whether that's, you know, improv or computer code or business strategy, yeah, craftsmanship is something that's very meaningful and very satisfying, but it also requires this presence and focus and concentration. And underneath all the busyness and the talk of connectivity and efficiency and productivity, the thing that actually moves the needle on the economic meter is the result of craftsmanship, the hard stuff, the stuff that's not easy to produce.
I'm curious when these very specific ideas started to perk up for you, because you're young. Are you millennial in terms of your generation?
I'm on the border. Depends who you ask.
Okay. Yeah. Right. But I mean, you've had these devices basically with you most of your life, right?
Well, I was right on the border. You know, I started college with no cell phone and no laptop, and ended college with cell phone and laptop. I started college before Facebook existed.
Yeah,
I ended college. All my friends were on Facebook. So I'm literally at the border of almost all of these trends.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm 50. So literally, when I went to high school, there was a computer class. I went the first day and then I never went back. It was so foreign to me. And then when I started at Second City, we didn't have computers, we didn't have cell phones. So that part is very new. So when did you start percolating around these ideas?
Well, I'd always been exposed to it starting around the time I went to grad school. So in grad school, I was studying to be a theoretical computer scientist, which is theorems and whiteboards. And that's one of the last fields where people still openly talk about the ability to concentrate as being a tier one skill. So I grew up in one of these rare areas. My sort of professional childhood, as it were, was in one of these rare areas where people still talk openly and explicitly about depth is important. The amount of concentration you can do is important. So I always had that in the back of my head. And when, as a writer, I began to turn my attention more broadly to broader audiences and broad economic issues, it was there in the back of my head, so I was able to make the connection. Wait a second, this thing is important not just for sort of weird geeks solving math theorems. This thing that I know about is probably more important than people realize across the economic spectrum.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about two specific things that I think are illustrative of what you're talking about in deep work. Open offices and instant messaging. You're not a fan of either of those, right?
Right. I'm down on open offices, and I'm under most conditions down on instant messaging as well.
Okay. Why are you down on open offices? I don't like them either, but I want to hear what you think.
Well, open offices are like a machine designed to prevent deep work. Hmm. And the motivation for them usually is, well, if people run into each other and can have these serendipitous collaborations, it's going to spur creativity. But it's like taking the Edison quote, 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration, and say, let's build our whole company around the 1% part.
Right.
It's forgetting the 99% part that actually matters, which is the hard, deep work necessary to actually act on it. So I'm a much bigger proponent of hub and spoke arrangements, like you see in the classic Bell Labs and Murray Hill or MIT Building 20, where you have places conducive to serendipitous encounters and discussion, but you also have people's offices, which are silent and isolated and places where they can work deeply and actually act on the ideas they come up with.
Yeah. So the reason I totally track with you, you know, there's a reason that the improv class is only 3 hours and that Second City rehearsals are only 3 to 4 hours. And that has been 60 years of doing this. And it's because what we figured out, and we did, this is anecdotal, but I'm sure there's science behind it at some point. There maybe is, or we need to figure it out, which is that human beings can only interact with each other for so long till it becomes ineffective and you can't come up with anything original.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. There's been trends I've been seeing recently. We're talking the last 6 months where suddenly you're starting to see these indications that companies are turning back on the open office concept, that it's probably past its peak. And now we have companies turning around and saying, OK, we got to try something different. So I'm optimistic that that trend is going to really reduce in its intensity in the near future.
How about instant messaging?
Well, my main problem with instant messaging is the use case of it, where the expectation is you always have it open and you're always available. And again, it's for the very simple reason, if you have distractions to what you're doing, even if it's just brief glances at an instant message window where you hit a quick note and then turn your attention back to what you're doing, even those brief distractions are enough to significantly reduce your cognitive capacity. It doesn't really count as deep work. You don't get the benefits of deep work if you have these small fragmentations of your attention sprinkled throughout what you're doing. So just like open offices, if you put me on a Slack window, you're basically saying, we do not want you to be able to operate at more than maybe 30 or 40% of your cognitive capacity while you're here at our company. And I just don't know why at a knowledge work organization you would want to do that to your employees.
I mean, it's so true. And literally, this was the problem when I was. So I do research. I tape the podcast once or twice a week and with all sorts of interesting people. And it's very important to me to read the book, right, and do the research. So I'm literally at Second City in a cubicle. Our office is burned down. That's another story. But I'm there trying to read your book as I'm getting instant messaged. And I realize I'm like, this does not work. So instead, and I don't normally do this, I took your book home and read it at night. Where my wife like demanded I not keep my iPad upstairs so I could just concentrate. And it was so much more obviously rewarding to sort of dig in with those ideas. Because conversely, it's like I was getting enough that we could have this conversation and I would sound like I reasonably knew what was going on. But it wouldn't have had the kind of impact that it did when I really sat down and read it all the way through.
Right. And you know, this is the problem, I think, is that we've told ourselves this story that being really accessible and connecting a lot throughout the day with coworkers is somehow synonymous with being productive or agile or a high-tech company. But I think that story is basically nonsense. What it really means is just you don't have much structure in place at your particular organization. If your organization depends on an ongoing, ad hoc, unstructured conversation all day long for things to get done, that's not a sign, in my opinion, that an organization is sort of agile or high tech. It just means they haven't figured out yet how they actually want to work.
Yeah.
And so I've been pushing back on this storyline that's coming out of Silicon Valley, that more connectivity, more interaction is always synonymous with better. More is better. You're more agile. You're more high tech. I think the most efficient companies of the future are going to have much, much more structured rules and systems for how people communicate and when they don't.
Yeah, and I think we're misrepresenting or misframing the how connectivity can be powerful, and it isn't it's in doses. So Second City, our corporate division, is brought into 300, 400 companies a year to teach people to be more collaborative, and when we do this, they can't have devices in front of them. Literally, that's the problem. We sort of say is that you're not listening all the way through. You're not actually connecting. And I, because we know connectivity is important, but not in the way, not the sort of digital way, which you're always available. It's actually in many ways the opposite of that.
Right. We're hijacking these concepts, which are very important, like collaboration or networks, and they're hijacked by some of these technologies and the storyline surrounding them, so that lots of other things can kind of slip in. You know, under the covers and be a part of the definition of these things and say, well, being on Slack all day, that's also connectivity or that's also collaboration. And by doing so, of course, it generates a lot of money for these companies, but it's been pretty terrible for the psyche of the workers.
Sure. It's a new buggy whip, you know, hiding out in a positive term. You actually quoted the New Yorker writer George Packer saying Twitter is crack for media addicts.
Yeah, exactly. I'm with him. I don't use Twitter, and it's not because I feel like I'm better than it. I as he said, I worry my kids would go hungry. I don't trust myself with it. They're too good. They're too good at engineering these things to be as addictive as possible.
So and at this given time, this is so important and true, because I will admit it, I am an addict on Twitter. And I convinced myself for a long period of time that I like the sort of ticker tape idea where I could get a snapshot of the news. And then I was just talking to Kristen Decker, our producer, about the fact that we're calling it news. This 140 characters, we think we're actually getting some truth inside of that, and especially these days, whatever your political stripe is, that's not, you know, there's not real truth or knowledge coming from that source.
Yeah, and people always make fun of me when I say things like this, but, you know, I've never had a Twitter account, and I actually, I read the paper Washington Post every morning. I get it delivered to my house, and I'm surrounded by people who are on all these services, and I'll tell you, I feel like I'm just as informed as anyone else on the nuances of what's going on in our country and the political process, and so yeah, I'm with you that we might be telling ourselves a bit of a story when we begin to back-justify that there's all this important things happening through some of these channels that we can't get elsewise.
Right. You're just not memeing about it like everyone else is.
Yeah, or if I am, I'm doing it at the breakfast table to my 4-year-old.
Yeah,
which is probably not as satisfying, I guess, as getting a Twitter like.
I think the live meme is actually a really good thing. You actually talk about Tom Cochran, the CTO of Atlantic Media, who monitored his own email use, and he found that he was averaging around 160 emails per day over a 5-day work week, which added up to, what, an hour and a half per day dedicated to essentially just moving information around like a human, I think you call it a human network router.
Right. And then he, because he's wonderfully geeky in this way, he went through the IT system at his company and tried to calculate how many emails was each of his employees sent, and then cross-tabulated that with their salary data, which he could then translate roughly into how much are we paying these people per hour, assuming a 40 to 50 hour work week. And in the end, calculated that the amount of money and salary they were spending for people to do email was enough for them to buy something like a Learjet every year. It was in the 7 figures. And that sort of took him aback. And he said, wait a second, we're spending a lot of money for people to be human network routers.
Yeah, yeah. And so with that and what we talked about earlier, this quote that you have from the social critic Matthew Crawford really spoke to me, which is that managers themselves inhabit a bewildering psychic landscape and are made anxious by the vague imperatives they must answer to. And that there's no better, the phrase is so right on in terms of, it's almost like we're in a Fellini movie. It just doesn't make sense, the things that we're doing.
It doesn't make sense, and mainly because a lot of the different knowledge work industries that exist right now are, in the real scheme of things, brand new.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the same pattern if you look at other major economic revolutions throughout history. So there's always this growing pains period where the technologies that are driving the revolution are new. We're not quite sure how to integrate them properly into the office. And so you get 20, 30 years, sometimes even more, where things are haphazard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's looking back is almost always looks naive and kind of funny. And so that's why I say this bewildering landscape we're in today in knowledge work, where we're on our smartphone in the middle of the night answering emails, and it's like an old, you know, Buster Keaton silent movie as we're trying
yep.
to keep up with this flow of information that actually has nothing to do with what our jobs are. It's going to get better. And in fact, the response I think that would be ahistorical would be the response that says the way we do things now, where we're always connected and are on email and Slack all day, this is the way that we're always going to do knowledge work. That's the ahistorical response.
Yeah.
It takes time to figure out how to do a technological revolution and fix it to business. It took a long time to figure out, for example, the assembly line after the Industrial Revolution started. Things are going to shake out. I think things are going to get better. We should not think that the way we work now, our very first attempt to figure out how to work in the age of digital communication, is going to end up being the right answer.
Yeah. All right. That makes me feel better. I think you're right. You're right. All right. I want to shift to craft and practice, because this is improvisation is all about practice and craft and process. And you take these principles around seeing improv as seeing obstacles as gifts, listening for intent, and making your partner look good. And as you practice this over and over, which is the thing that we call the process, you build ensembles that make incredible content. And I think this is what you're talking about when you write, quote, a wooden wheel is not noble, but its shaping can be. The same applies to knowledge work. You don't need a rarefied job. You need instead a rarefied approach to work.
Yeah, I think this is true. You know, the book I wrote before this one was in part about this cultural obsession that my generation has with this notion of following your passion, and there's this one true job you're supposed to do, and it put all of this focus on the attributes of the job you had, and is the job you have the right job or the best job or the job that's best fit to your personality. And when I looked into that topic, what became clear is that a lot of satisfaction in the workplace is not about this perfect match of this is just the right job for, you know, my genetic heritage or something like this. It has a lot to do with how you approach to work. And this is an idea that goes back through millennia of skilled labor, is that there's nobility and satisfaction and meaning in crafts for craftsmanship's sake. And it's a lot of the reason why I think deep work can also be good for your soul in addition
yep.
to just being good for your paycheck. It's something that we seem wired, regardless of what we're doing the craft on, we're wired for craftsmanship. We feel better. We feel emboldened. We feel creative. We feel satisfied when we're actually creating something new that was hard to create and took skill and has value to the world.
Yeah, and I think what we've discovered in our work is that you have to instill habits. That we're not naturally oriented to work well together. Not really naturally oriented to work successfully. Period. Our brains are, you know, they're sometimes not so good. And so what we do in our work is instill habit building practices. So it's you know, when you're first beginning to improvise, it's all about focus and listening. And then gradually it's about then, you know, being others focused and listening with intent. And, you know, you sort of escalate in this. But the other thing is you don't just stop. You don't. So it's like going to a gym once and saying you're done. You know, now I'm in shape. You recognize that you need to sort of keep doing this stuff to build up your craft. And you actually talk about working in groups and ensembles. And that's important because, you know, deep work, I think, is primarily thought of as a solitary effort. But when you collaborate, that when it gets a little tricky, right?
It can get tricky, but you're right to underscore that deep work does not have to be just a solitary endeavor. And just like you witness in the improv troops that you're training, I see this in other fields as well, that mm-hmm. working with other people can actually help sort of accelerate the results you get or improve your craft or improve the level of depth you get. But as you noted, it's hard.
Yeah.
So if you just throw a lot of people in an open office and say, be collaborative, that's not going to help. But if you take three computer developers and you do team programming at a given screen, and we're all looking at the same screen,
mm-hmm.
and we all have the social pressure to keep our concentration focused here because I don't want to be the one who loses the train, or trying to help each other get the best possible code, you can come out of that 10% better coder than when you did the session. So collaboration, working with other people, can be a core component of applying deep work and building a deep work skill, but it requires some careful structure.
Yeah, and I think people tend to think it needs to be one or the other. But if you take even outside of improvisation, look at sports, it's like, you know, Michael Jordan practiced those free throws over and over and over again, but it was doing that and becoming basically a great ensemble member with his other people that made those great Bulls teams.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what you're trying to avoid when doing real deep work or improving a craft is sort of unplanned or unstructured distraction that keeps taking your mind away from the task at hand. So you can have a group of people doing something free of those external distractions, like a Chicago Bulls practice session or something, where they're not also answering their phone and answering questions from the stand while they practice. And it's just the same. I mean, the key factor is not how many people are there. It's what's the focus of the brains involved. Are the brains fixed on one clear goal that they're trying to do at the highest level, or are the brains being pulled in a lot of different ad hoc directions?
Right. And we find that there are ways then to give exercises where people have to then shift their focus, and naturally then the game changes. And this is important because it's a power that you've got. Okay, I'm going to ask you, we're coming close to the end. I'm going to ask you a yes and story. But before that, I really dug the concept. And I don't know if it's yours or you got it from somewhere else, but this idea about productive meditation. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, it's a strategy that helps you increase your ability to sustain your focus. It's a pretty simple exercise. You take a professional problem, you go for a walk. While you're walking, you try to make progress on the problem just in your head. And borrowing from mindfulness meditation, when you notice your attention start to wander from the problem and think about other things, you just notice that and bring it back to the problem. If you do this, at first it's going to be difficult. Your mind's going to wander all over the place, but you do this again and again and again. You're going to find that you're able, over time, to hold things in your head longer and make more progress with them just mentally.
That's great. Yeah, I've often referred to improv as being loud group mindfulness, which is taking place between obviously the people on stage, but also the audiences, because, you know, we have this agreement that we all know we don't know what's coming next. And there's a sort of a wonderful pulling together of focus. And the other thing that I love about the comedy aspect of what we do is it's one of the rare forms of entertainment where when comedy is working, it means everyone's laughing at the same time. And so, like, you know, my wife, who's a comedy professor, kind of thinks that a laugh is a moment of insight, and then it's a collective moment of insight potentially for people. So kind of interesting area to delve into. Okay, so, you know, we ask our guests for a yes and story. You know, we say no so often in our lives, and sometimes we say yes, but it seems to me that some of the best moments that people have in their lives and their careers is when they take the chance to say yes and. Do you have one of those stories for us?
Well, I mean, I think this whole trajectory of these books I've been writing on the world of business, you could almost think of it as the result of one of these yes and stories. I used to, when I was younger, college student, early grad student, I was writing books for students and student advice books, and I was I had a blog on student advice and how to go through college and how to study, and I was touring the country giving talks to students about how to study, doing all these type of things. And essentially the question that came down from my publisher is, hey, can you write us another book? Essentially, it's like, yeah, yes, I will. And however, can I try a different topic while I'm at it? And that's that simple decision of like, yeah, yes, but and I would also like to try a different topic completely changed the type of things I was working on, the people I get to meet, the type of ideas I get to play with. So it was a good turning point for me.
Yeah, you seem to be writing about where you're at.
Yes.
And that it seems like, wow, that's a very simple idea that I don't think a lot of people recognize might be at their fingertips.
Yeah, when I stopped being a student, I started writing books about life after being a student. And yeah. It makes sense. It's a way to use a publisher's money to investigate very thoroughly topics that are relevant to my life. I don't think they realize that yet, so don't let them hear this.
I won't. Dan Kalnofer, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
When I've been working in a home.